Imagine growing up in a family, and don't think particularly about your family. Just imagine, totally hypothetically, you grew up in a family, and your parents were just not very nice. They weren't kind, they weren't friendly, they weren't generous, they never gave you anything. And all through your life, you kind of grow up wondering, how in the world are these my parents? And then one day, you're up in the loft in the attic, and you discover a box, and it's covered in dust, and it's got string tied around it, and you kind of undo it, and you start delving through it, and you discover in that box proof that actually your parents are not your parents. They abducted you, they were criminals, they stole you from the hospital, and they are not your real parents. You'd think, I knew it. And then you keep looking and you discover that actually your mother was a famous artist who was just an incredible painter or singer, something like that. And your father was a professional sportsman. And then after that, he was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist. Oh, whatever, right? Just an imaginary, amazing heritage. You see, with all of that information, what changes? Because your life has been your life. You've lived your life. You're used to living your life. Your parents downstairs are the people you live with or whatever. But suddenly you know that there's something different. And the something different is actually on the inside. Right? You start thinking, oh my goodness, I've got the DNA of a Nobel Prize winner. I've got the DNA of a famous artist and a sportsman, and you start exercising. And all these thoughts would start swirling through your mind. Now, technically, nothing's changed. That has always been true of you. But in that moment, your mind starts going. And you start thinking, I'm different. There's something different about me than I even knew. What if Christianity is like that? What if Christianity is something that most people think is external, right? It's sort of historical. It's a historical faith based on things that happened 2,000 years ago. Or it's external, like it's a code of living that people choose to kind of put themselves under. Or it's future, like thousands of years or whenever in the future, when I die, when it's all finished, I get to go to heaven. A lot of people think of Christianity in those terms. It's distant past, it's distant future, and it's outside of me now. But what if Christianity, at the very core, is actually something on the inside? Something that changes within us. Something that transforms our identity. It transforms our purpose, our reason for existence. Everything is transformed, and it's not just from the outside in, but it's transformed from the inside out. Well, we're in this series, and we're just finishing the series today, and we've followed the book and the video series 3-2-1. Okay, so we've got copies of the book out there. If you haven't got a hold of that, please grab one. It's our gift to you. And it's really just a kind of a window shopper's introduction. It's like, hey, come on in, let me show you around. Here's Christianity. And so the simple progression of that is 3, the story of God, 2, the story of the world, and 1, the story of you. So 3, who is God? God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit, 3 persons united in love. That's the story of who God is, and that changes everything. If God is that God, then, whoa, we need to rethink Christianity. If we're thinking of God as a distant, angry judge that is just, ready to crush everybody who disobeys, we've got a confused picture of who he is. And so that was the 3. And then we thought about the 2, and the 2 is the story of the world, and the Bible basically tells us that everybody in the world is either in Team Adam, that is normal human, or in Team Jesus. And it's not, we thought about this last week, it's not like there's 2 captains and they kind of pick and, end up with 2 teams and too bad, you're on the wrong team. No, what happens is all of humanity is in one team, and then Jesus comes in and he rescues those willing to be rescued to bring them onto his team. And so the whole world is divided between people who are living simply a human life without God and those who through Christ have found relationship with God. Okay, so that's where we were last week. the story of the world, number two. And this week we come to the number one. And the number one is the offer. In light of all of that, in light of who God is, and in light of what Jesus has done to rescue us from our sin and from all the mess and the mess-ups and the kind of confusion of our lives, in light of all that he's done, here's the invitation. Be one with Jesus. Would you be one with Jesus? We're going to explain that. We're going to think about that. Now, you might be sat here today thinking, I've never ever really thought about what Christianity is. I've never been to church. I've never heard it presented, in which case it's going to seem new anyway. But actually, there will be people here today who have maybe been Christians for decades, for years and years and years. And yet you're thinking, interesting, be one with Jesus. Union with Christ. We're going to see that phrase in what we say today. Union with Christ. That's not something I've heard much about. I know for me, I grew up in the church. I attended church my entire life. I listened sometimes, but I attended church. In fact, I attended lots of churches. My dad was a preacher, so I heard preaching in all these Italian churches, and I got assaulted by these Italian old people that then gave me wonderful food, so I forgave them. I say assaulted. They used to grab my cheek. It used to hurt, you know, but it was loving. And so I grew up hearing preaching, and I went to church in Bristol, and I went to conferences, and I went to different churches, and I can say that for years and years and years and years, I did not know that what we're going to talk about today is the heart of Christianity. I thought that Christianity was fairly straightforward, but my understanding was a bit external. I understood that, yeah, 2,000 years ago, God's Son came into this world and he lived a perfect life and he died on the cross. He died a horrible death and he died my death. He died in my place to pay the penalty for my sin. And he rose again and he's gone back to be with his Father. And here I am today and I can get the benefits of what he's done. All right, because he's died for me, I don't have to pay the penalty for my sin. All the mess-ups, all the yucky stuff, all the gross thoughts, all the things that I regret, all the things that I'm ashamed of, I do not have to pay the penalty for those things because Jesus has taken the penalty on himself. And so if I trust him and ask him to forgive me, I can be forgiven and I can be in his family. And in the future, when I die, I get to go and be with him in heaven. That was my understanding of Christianity. But if you think about it, there's a progression there that goes around me. There's the past. The present is kind of I trust and then I live the Christian life. Then there's the future. But what about me? What happens in me? Does anything happen in me? Is there any sense that this is more than just a change of status? Is Christianity basically like taking your passport? I've got a British passport, putting it in the post, sending it off, and then receiving back a different passport. Oh, I'm now Namibian. You see, legally, I can change my nationality just simply by exchanging passports. I'm not sure they take me, but you know, it's as simple as that. What's my nationality? Well, I'm Namibian or Canadian or Swiss or whatever, but the reality is I'm still me and I still feel really British. Nothing's actually changed if I simply exchange passports. But for years, I felt like Christianity was that. That I've gone from being a sinner who deserves hell, and I've made a legal exchange, and now I have a ticket to heaven. Now I have a new status. But we're talking about union with Christ. That's different. That's deeper. That's like going down to the DNA level of something happening on the inside of who I am. In fact, I was reading this week, I was reading about this subject, and I want to share with you some quotes. Okay, these are quotes. I'm not going to tell you who they're by, most of them, but these are quotes from 500 years ago, 400 years ago, 300. I don't know if I've got any 200s. Certainly 50 and present day. So a real spread of quotes. Let's have a look at them. Okay, first one. Union with Christ is the subject. This is accorded by us the highest degree of importance. This is the most important thing. Next. this is right at the center of the Christian understanding of salvation. Let's do another one. This is theological shorthand for the gospel itself. All right, that's a pretty strong statement. Let's go for another one. This is the ultimate doctrine. I won't tell you who said that, but he was Welsh, and so some of you probably will guess. Okay, next. This is the greatest, most honorable, and glorious of all the gifts we get to share. Let's do another one. This is really the central truth of Christian salvation. And last one, I'll show you who this one is, C.S. Lewis. The whole offer which Christianity makes is this, that we can, if we let God have his way, come to share in the life of Christ. So union with Christ, it's what it's saying is, when we become Christians, we don't just get a status change. We are united to him. We become one with him. Our life and his life become the same life. In Bible terms, we've seen this in the previous 2 weeks. In the three, we looked at John 17, where Jesus is praying, and Jesus is talking to his Father, and he's praying for us, which is an amazing thing. And in that prayer, he's talking to his Father, and he's talking about their relationship, and he says, I in you, and you in me, and us in them. And you go, really? That's what? How does that work? I in you, and you in me, and us in them. It's such simple words, but it's such a big concept. The life that God enjoys within himself, he wants us to be united to that. He wants us to share in that. Last week, we were in Romans 5, and in Romans 5, as Paul's describing all the blessings that are ours in salvation, he says this amazing thing. He says, the love of God is poured out into our hearts by the Holy Spirit that he has given to us. That's not just God blessing me from a distance, but God coming within me to be inside me by his Spirit. And so what is union with Christ? It is that God or Christ is in me by his Spirit, and that I am in him. My life is hidden with Christ in God. My life is wrapped up in him. In the same way that years ago I married Melanie and I went from being single Peter to being married Peter, I became one with her, still a separate human, but we're one person. We're one as a couple. There's a oneness and a unity to us. That's what Christ is offering to us. If you go through the whole of the New Testament and you read through it looking for the word Christian, do you know how many times you'll find it? In all of the New, in fact, the whole Bible, how many times will you see the word Christian? Once? Any advances on one? The answer is two or three. It's not many. You're causing me to doubt myself now. I think it's three. Okay, it's not many. So you're right. It's hardly there at all as a word. But if you go through the letters of Paul, now Paul wrote about half the books of the New Testament, okay? So Romans and Corinthians and Ephesians, all these letters, Paul wrote them. So about half of the letters of the New Testament, he uses a phrase, very simple. It's in Christ. In Christ. I listened through all of his letters this week while I was traveling just to kind of let them wash over me, and I didn't count them, but here's how many times in Christ or in him appears in Paul alone. 165 times. You could say, and I think is a good point to this, you could say that this concept of union with Christ is the very heart of Paul's understanding of Christianity. And so how is it that I can grow up in the church listening to preaching and become a Christian and kind of not be aware of it? And if that's true for me, maybe that's true for some of you. That we've always seen Christianity as this kind of external thing, past and future and status change, but what about union? What about shared life? What about the life of God in my soul? Oh, that sounds fruity. That sounds good. I want that. Whatever that is, I want that. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a verse, just one verse today, not a whole chapter, one verse that gives us a sense of how this works. And so it's Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. You're welcome to grab a Bible if you want, but I'm going to put the verse on the screen for us, and we're going to see it there. That's all we're going to look at, really simple. But what this verse contains, essentially, is all the elements of the gospel, the good news message. What is it that preachers preach? Well, they preach Jesus crucified, and they preach Jesus resurrected, and they preach the love of God, and they preach new life, and all of that is here. Okay, so let me read the verse to you. I have been crucified with Christ. So Paul's writing this, and he's describing his own situation. He says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. That's a verse worth kind of burying into your heart somewhere so that it's there, right? That's an amazing little nutshell nugget of gospel truth. Let's think about what it's saying here. First of all, it talks about a death. You see at the top of the verse there, I have been crucified with Christ and I no longer live. Whose death is it? Well, crucified is the word that immediately brings to mind the death of Jesus, the greatest image of Christianity, right? The cross. And it was a horrible thing. I mean, literally, it was designed to be as horrific and as incredibly offensive as it possibly could be. If you've got an image in mind of a sort of majestic cross on the top of a hill, you know, with soldiers looking up at Jesus, it was nothing like that. The cross, the Roman cross, was a deterrent. It was something they did to keep people under control. They were paranoid about people rioting and breaking the law and breaking the peace and making it so that business and the economy didn't work. And so they kind of controlled people by force. And what they would do is they would, when they caught a criminal, they would crucify them as an example to everybody. So you wouldn't put it on some distant hill outside the city. You'd put the cross right next to the road so that as people are coming in and out, they're walking next to these people that are hanging and dying on these crosses. Actually, I was amazed when I went to Israel to discover that typically they would be crucified at eye level. I'd always thought that, but eye level. So the arms outstretched and nailed to the wood, the legs twisted and nailed to the wood. And so if that person is going to take a breath to be able to breathe or stay conscious or talk, which they wouldn't do much of, they would have to lift themselves up in order to get oxygen and air into their lungs. And that's where we get the word excruciating. Excruciating is the most powerful, searing pain imaginable. It's what they went through on the cross as they'd lift themselves up to take a breath. And the nerves and the pain is astonishing. And so Christ was crucified. It's weird, isn't it? How's that the center of the Christian faith? Well, it's because of who he was, and it was because of how much he didn't deserve it. He was a son of God. He came to this world. He lived a perfect life. If anybody did not deserve that, it was him. But he willingly went to the cross. That was his plan. That was his Father's plan. And he did that for us. So he went to the cross and he died on the cross. And in that death, the punishment that we deserve for the things that we've done wrong was poured out on him. But Paul isn't just talking about Christ crucified, is he? What is he saying? I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live. He's actually talking about himself. Now, Paul is not saying literally when Jesus was crucified in 30 AD just outside the gate in Jerusalem that I was on a cross next to him. He's not saying that. What he's saying is I am so connected to Christ now that when he died, I died. My life, everything that I'd lived for, everything that I'd done, all of everything that wrapped up in a big package was me, is gone. I died with him. In fact, he makes up a word here. He takes the word crucified and he takes the word co or with and he squishes them together. I was co-crucified with Christ. I was with crucified. He's trying to get this sense across that when Jesus died, I died. Now, that's good news, but it doesn't feel like it. How is that good news? Let me illustrate it to you like this. Has anybody here ever watched either Britain's Got Talent, American Idol, X Factor, or The Voice? That probably covers most of it, okay? We're all kind of on board somewhat with the concept. I can't think of anything more frightening than appearing on any of those things, especially if it involves singing, because I can't sing to save my life. But when you watch the contestants, you see them backstage and they're all nervous, right? And then they come out on stage and they stand on the spot and they perform. And then a panel of experts who are paid to be unfriendly in many cases are sitting there evaluating them. And then there's a huge audience and then there's millions of people at home. And they know that they're going to be evaluated. They know that if they sing one note out of tune, if they put one foot wrong, if they're dancing, if they do one thing slightly out, that's the end. Their career is over. Their dreams are shattered. And so they're living in round after round of constant fear-filled evaluation. Right? Isn't that essentially what the programs are? And isn't life a bit like that? Isn't it sometimes we feel we're a little bit like that, that we're constantly performing and we're constantly falling short? We fall short in front of our bosses at work. We fall short in front of our families at home, in front of our friends. We can never live up, and so then we pretend and we put on a mask, and if they could just see, and we hide it, and we try harder, and there's all of this fear wrapped up in trying to be somebody in this world, right? And we put forward our best face on Facebook and our best this and our best that. And it's not just Sunday best anymore. Like, everybody is living this performance under constant evaluation, and it feels just horrible. And that's life. That's life when I'm on my own and I've got to prove myself and I've got to be somebody. And anybody out there at any moment could tell me you're a failure. Any moment they could put a pin in the balloon and I would just deflate. And that's what life feels like. And I wonder if at some deep level that's why people watch those programs, kind of, hoping that the good ones progress. But knowing deep down that we're not fans of being evaluated. We don't like it. It feels, ugh. And Paul says, that Paul, the Paul who tried, and the Paul who strove, the Paul who put in all the effort, the Paul who tried to be the best he could be, the Paul who was trying to be Mr. Successful, he died with Christ. Doesn't live anymore. That old me is gone. The constant treadmill effort of trying to succeed and trying to please everybody, it's finished. That life is gone now. Because when Jesus died, evaluation was done. And so I don't live my life waiting for an X or for a thumbs up or for anything from anyone, because I'm not living based on who I am anymore. I'm dead. That old me is gone. That life of all self-effort is finished. Doesn't that sound like good news? Doesn't that feel like a weight gets lifted? I've been crucified with Christ. And I no longer live. And he's not depressed when he says this. I think he's saying it with that tone. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. Notice that when you hear Christianity presented in the Bible, when the message is presented, you'll get the death of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus. It's not just that Jesus died for us. It's that having died, he rose again. Having faced the penalty for sin, which is death, he conquered death. He came out of the tomb. And if you're sat here this afternoon thinking, I'm not sure about this whole Christianity thing, what I would say to you is this: chase the resurrection. Like, be as skeptical as you want and chase the evidence. Did Jesus actually physically, literally stand up and walk out of the tomb? Because if he did, then everything else that the Bible says is really worth thinking about. And if he didn't, and you can prove he didn't, then pressure's off. You can walk away. It doesn't matter. But over the years, people have tried to explore and investigate and prove that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. And many, many times, those people have ended up trusting him.
and becoming Christians, even preachers, because they found that he did. Christ lives. He's alive. And so, what does Paul say here? Christ lives in me. Just like he says, Christ was crucified, me too. Now he's saying Christ lives in me. He's connecting himself to Christ. He's saying, I am so connected with Christ that Christ's life now is not just sitting on a throne in heaven somewhere. His life is bubbling up inside of me. All right, the old me, the independent me, the my own effort me, dead. Now Christ is living in me. That's very different. If Christ is living in you, there's a life there that you never see in people that don't know him. Now, that's not to say that, you know, Christians walk around like superheroes with no problems. We have problems, we have struggles, we have all sorts of doubts and fears and complexities, and when things hurt, they hurt. You know, they hurt us just like they hurt others. That's all true, but there's something about the life of a Christian that just, there's something bubbling up there. In the midst of sorrow, there can be joy. In the midst of struggle, there can be hope. The fruit of the Spirit, he talks about later in the letter, where the Spirit is at work in a life, the fruit of that is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and gentleness and faithfulness and self-control. There's a fruitfulness. It's like when you watch a Christian, someone who's in union with Christ, there's something vibrant about them that you don't see in others. It's almost like watching somebody on X Factor or whichever show is yours of choice. You see them through all the rounds, all the nerves, all the fear, all the evaluation, all the pressure. And then you get to the final show and they win. And after they've won and the announcement has been made that they've won and they're all happy and huggy and cry and all that stuff that artistic people do, then what do? They get the microphone and they sing. Only now there's no pressure. Do you know what I mean? It's like the music just comes out of them and they just let it go and they let it rip and they sing. And there's something so free about that performance compared to all the others. I've got a friend who, I think only one friend who sings worse than me. He's not here. But I mean, okay, let's say he's as bad as me. I don't want to say he's worse than me. That's not fair. He's louder than me. And when he sings, you can hear, like if he was here, you'd hear his voice over everything. The sound guy would be like, oh my goodness, he's like trying to hide it, but it would just boom. It's like the loudest football fan you can imagine when he sings. It's just this voice goes out. And you know, the beautiful thing about it is when I hear him sing, he's singing about Jesus. And he doesn't care. He's completely unself-aware, and he just lets it rip. Literally, you can have 200 people in a room, and his voice booms out over everyone in a slightly different key, but it booms out over everyone. And in a way, it's like, ooh, that doesn't sound good. But actually, it's really fun. It's really nice. You find yourself going, oh, because he's so in love with Jesus that he doesn't care. It's just pouring out of him. It's like he's living in that song, Christianity. And maybe it's not the singer that you see, it's the Christian next door or the Christian at church, the person who seems able to trust God in the darkest of times, who seems to have hope when everyone else is hopeless, who seems to have a different perspective and a vibrancy and a sort of a color about them where everything else is black and white. Christ lives in me. That's what Paul's saying. Notice the verse, if we can get it back. Christ who lives in me and the life I now live in the flesh. So he's not saying I died with Christ and now I'm, you know, a corpse. What he's saying is the old me died with Christ and now Christ is alive in me. There's a connection between us. He's living inside me by his Spirit. And so there's a life coming out of me now that's his life, so that as I'm living this life in the body, here I am, still moving, still alive, the life I now live in the flesh. And then he says how this works. How is it that there's a connection between Christ's death and me, between Christ's life and me? How is it possible for all of this to converge in your life or in mine? You come to the third bit. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. How is it possible for the death of Jesus to make any difference to me? How is it possible for the life of Jesus to be at work in me? The message of the Bible all the way through is that the mechanism is faith. Now, what does that mean? Well, we're all people of faith, okay? That don't start saying, well, I'm not a person of faith. You're sitting on a chair, you're trusting that chair. You look at it, you think, yeah, that looks safe enough, and you put your weight on it. That's faith. And for Christians, we look at Christ and what he's done and the promises of God and the cross and the empty tomb and all of the offer. We look at all of that and we say, okay, and we place our weight on it. That is so compelling, I'm going to entrust myself to that. That's what faith is. And Paul's saying that is how we access union with Christ. That's how we get what he's describing here. It's by faith. It's not by works, it's not by effort, it's not by performance. The evaluation is done. Jesus has been evaluated. The judgment has been taken care of. We don't have to live up to anything. We simply place our weight on him. No plan B, no alternative solution, no, well, if that doesn't work, I'll have a little bit of this. It's just 100%, I'm yours. I trust you. I suppose when you think about that, it changes the X Factor illustration one more time, doesn't it? It's not just that you know, we live life performing and trying and being evaluated, and then there's a victory, and then we, you know, get to really live and really sing, and it bubbles out of our hearts. It's actually that the evaluation was done of Jesus, that he was evaluated, and we are saying, I'm with him. And then when he is declared the victor and he comes on stage to sing and to live, we step up with him and say, yeah, I'm with him. And so the life we live is a life of faith in him, trusting that he will accept us, trusting that he won't turn around and say, oi, off you go, I'm the singer. But trusting that instead he'll embrace us and bring us next to him and let us live with him as he sings in that moment. The biblical illustration for that is marriage. That we are united to Christ like a bride is united to a bridegroom, where all of the debts and all of the grossness and all of the yucky stuff and all the mess of her life, in the moment they get married, becomes his stuff. He's got her debts. He's got her all of her history, all of her past, all of the baggage that comes with her. Now it's his. And when she marries him, all of the righteousness and the goodness and the life and the perfection of who he is becomes hers. It's the great exchange that takes place at a wedding. And the Bible describes the invitation to us, not simply change your status, but come and be married to the Son of God. Come and bring with you all the baggage, all the debt, all the shame, all the guilt, all the stuff. Bring it and he'll take it. And he brings all the perfection and the wonder and the glory of heaven, and he gives it to you. If you imagine going to a wedding and having a conversation with the bride or groom, whichever your friend is, you know, you normally get like 2 minutes if you're lucky at a wedding, right, to kind of have a little chat. And so let's say you're at a reception and you're talking to the bride or the groom, and you start talking to them about, It's great that you got married. Woo. I love the way you're taking a stand on the political issue of marriage. I love how you're reinforcing the framework of stability for society. Imagine like going on like that for a few minutes, the looks they would give you. Like, what are you talking about? Or if you go to them and say, married, huh? Bet you had to really work up your feelings for today. Bet you had to really, you know, really kind of eat a hearty breakfast to make sure that you're really committed when you say those vows. It would be weird, wouldn't it? It would get some awkward stares, not least from the person who just got married, because they would be thinking, what in the world are you talking about? Why are you talking to me about marriage or about my feelings and my, you know, indigestion or whatever? What are you talking about? The most wonderful person in the world over there, that most wonderful person in the world wants to marry me. That's what a marriage is, right? A marriage is when you're so captivated by the other person that you're not thinking about yourself or about the framework of the relationship. You're just captivated by them. And so when you look at this verse that is coming back again, the last little bit of it here, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. If you're like me, you'd probably find your mind and your heart moving towards the underlined bit. I live by faith. I don't have enough faith. I need to work on my faith. I need to have more faith. I wish I had your faith. And, you know, all those kind of things that we say to one another. Oh, my faith is too puny. My faith is too small. But that's not where the emphasis is. The emphasis for Paul here is on the other part. I live by faith in the Son of God, the one who loved me and gave himself for me. Doesn't that sound like somebody captivated by the person that's wanting to marry them? The most wonderful person in the world wants to marry me. And everything just goes in that direction. Everything moves towards them. You entrust yourself to the person, not because you've worked up the entrusting, but because they're so wonderful, you can do nothing but. That's Christianity. That's the invitation. It's not evaluate this, work this out. Do you want to kind of do this transaction and change your status? Please fill out this form. That's not Christianity. At the heart of Christianity, you've got Jesus Christ, the Son of God, in all of his beauty and all of his perfection, dying a hideous, humiliating death on a cross as a proposal to you. That's a proposal. In John's gospel, it says that when the Son of Man is lifted up, he will draw all people to himself. His being lifted up on the cross was to invite us to trust ourselves to him. When I proposed to Melanie, I planned it as meticulously as I could, and I made it as big of a deal as I could. This was pre-YouTube days, so it wasn't that big of a deal, but it was a big deal for us, and I really made a big deal of it. Westminster Abbey and, you know, all these details. But that was nothing compared to the proposal that Jesus has made. He's come from heaven to this earth, and he's gone all the way to the cross, and hanging there, humiliated and bleeding and dying, just giving up his complete life. What he's saying is, I'm dying for you. What he's saying is, I love you this much. What he's saying is, will you entrust yourself to me? And then he rose from the dead. He conquered death. He's victorious. And the invitation is not just 2,000 years ago. The invitation is now. Jesus is alive now. And by his Spirit now, he's drawing us and saying, go on, trust him. Trust him. He loves you. Trust him. You can trust him. He loves you more than you could ever love yourself. Isn't it a wonderful, wonderful invitation? To be able to say, actually, all the striving and all the effort and all the performing and all the evaluations and all the fear that one day I'm going to make a wrong note and it's going to be all done, that's all gone. Because I've been crucified with Christ. And now, instead of striving and living in my own strength and continuously falling short, now Christ is alive in me. How do we get that? By faith. By trusting ourselves to him. Just like you look at a chair and say, that can take my weight, and you put your full weight on it. Look to the love of God. Look at Jesus. Look at the cross. Think about what he's done and put your full weight on him. That's the invitation. And when you do that, what you discover is not only does he change your status, by his Spirit he comes in. Changes you from the inside, so that just like if you found that box with that information that convinced you your DNA was different than you realized, when you become a Christian, you become something different than you were before, at the very core of who you are. And that's the invitation of the gospel. There are three persons united in love. And in this world, we're all on the wrong side. We're all living in rebellion. We're all trying to do it in our own strength. But Jesus has come to extend that love to us. And if we're prepared to entrust ourselves to him, to put our full weight, not just for now, but for all eternity, fully on him, then he invites us into a marriage union with him. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live. but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. 3, 2, 1. That's the invitation. Will you be one with Jesus? For some of you, that might be the first time you've ever heard that. Please talk to one of us afterwards, find out more, ask your questions. It's all important. For some of you, maybe you've been Christians for many, many years, and you think, actually, I need to think more about that. I need to think more about what it means to have union with Christ. You won't be wasting your time. It's such a wonderful subject. It's so important.